From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It's the Craig Needles Podcast here at ClassicRock981.com, LondonNewsToday.ca, and you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, the Craig Needles Podcast is brought to you by our friends over at the Covent Garden Market and at downtown London. Well, let's talk housing today. And who better to talk housing with than Mike Moffitt, who does all the things in all the places.
All the housing stuff.
Yeah, all the housing stuff. And noted failed academic. Is that what Pierre Poilievre
called you? And that's Enhancer now. That is official, Government of Canada position.
Yeah.
Failed liberal academic. Hoping to get that on a t-shirt or a sweatshirt.
Yeah. Looking forward to that. Well, let's wait till your birthday.
There we go.
So you are here to talk housing with us because you're part of a new report, and I saw it last week, and I messaged you and said, hey, you know what, I'd love to talk about this. And you said, well, great, I'm going to be in London. So here you are sitting across from me in person doing one of these for the first time. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic to be here. Fantastic to be back home.
Tell me about this report, and the first top line piece that I noticed about it was you had all the names of the people who helped contribute to it. There's 15, and it was people with a variety of different perspectives. I don't think anyone's going to call Lisa Raitt a failed liberal academic.
I don't know. She might be hanging too close to one, but
Either way, it's people with a whole lot of different political perspectives. So tell me about the report and how the idea of putting this together all came about.
Yeah, so it was an initiative of a group called the Clean Economy Fund, and the CEO is a former coworker of mine. So we sat down together last summer and kind of hatched this plan where we brought together a bunch of Canadians from all over the country and all different perspectives. And, you know, we had sort of a wish list of people we wanted involved. So Eric wanted Don Iveson, the former mayor of Edmonton, and we were lucky enough to get him. I pitched Lisa Raitt, the former deputy prime minister. I thought she'd be fantastic for this, and lucky for us, she said yes. So they chaired this thing, and we had a number of other people involved in it. Mark Carney's was involved, mm-hmm. Cherise Berta, big housing researcher from TMU, Ren Thomas from Dalhousie. We had First Nations groups, we had Métis involvement. Really, really important. The one thing I kind of failed at is I kept pitching other people to run this thing, be the secretary of it. And none of them either wanted to do it or they wanted to be involved but not take on that role. So that kind of fell to me. So it's been, it's been a challenging few months. I call it a very challenging group project when you get 15 of the smartest housing people in Canada, all with very different perspectives. You know, lock them in kind of a virtual room together and say, okay, you know, we've got to find what we can all agree on. And we made it work.
Yeah. And you came up with some interesting stuff here. And some of the top line info, you said there are five sort of interlocking problems: where we build, what we build, how we build, why we build, and foundations for success. So let's start with where we build. And you and I have talked about that before, that we've got to be pretty smart here. Not just that we build a whole lot of stuff, that we're not paving over a whole lot of farmland and making that happen to do it. So where was the where we build part of this for you?
Yeah, it was exceptionally important because we had four basic goals that we set out for ourselves. First, that we're creating enough supply to meet the CMHC target. Second, that these homes are affordable to all Canadians. We have homes at all price points. Three, that we meet our carbon budget. But four, that we also make these homes resilient. We've seen forest fires, storms near oceans and floods and so on. So that where we build is incredibly important from a climate perspective, partly because we know that areas are prone to flooding, prone to fire. So there's no use in building in those areas if we're going to just have to rebuild in 5 or 10 years. You know, we've had debates here in London with, the project going up at Windermere and Adelaide, that kind of thing. So we don't get into that level of granularity, but what we suggest is, you know, let's look for those areas that we shouldn't be building in, set those aside, And, you know, if we have to expand urban growth boundaries or what have you on less environmentally sensitive land. So that's important. But also where we build is important for a climate perspective because of transportation emissions.
Right.
You know, if we're able to build near transit lines and that kind of thing, you know, that's going to help both climate, but also helps affordability if you don't have to buy a, you know, second car to get your kids around and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that definitely helps. And I think that when, you know, we get into the 15-minute city conspiracy, we don't have to do that. But I think people generally like the idea of, oh, the things I need are close to me. Yeah, there are going to be those who want to live out in the country and not have a lot of stuff right around the corner and have all that space, and that's great. But I think generally people say, hey, I like the idea of where I live, the things that I need are not far away. And maybe I can take transit to get there. Maybe I don't have to start my car every time I want to go to the mall or whatever it is.
Well, that's just it. And we really framed this report to be positive, right? So it's not a lot of don't do this. It's more let's
please do that.
Please do that. Or even please allow to do that. Yeah. One of the terms we use a lot in here is legalized density. So we're not saying, hey, you know, don't do this, don't do that. But we're saying, hey, a lot of people want to live in walkable communities. They want to live near transit lines. But we don't allow them to do it because of a variety of rules and regulations. So we're saying, okay, let's do what we can to change those. So, for instance, we have a lot of rules in cities and in this country that you need to have so many parking spaces, whether it be an industrial site, a commercial site, retail, or housing site. We're saying, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense, particularly if you've got housing near transit lines. We had a case in Ottawa where they were trying to make affordable housing. Housing that would be lived in by people on OW and ODSP, and you know how much, you know, or how little those are because you've spoken to it a lot on here. Yet the city in Ottawa was requiring this project to have so many parking spaces and so many EV chargers. Now, I can tell you there's not a lot of folks on OW and ODSP driving Teslas. So we're saying let's get rid of these rules that kind of gum up the works and allow people to make the choices that make sense for them. If they want to live a car-free lifestyle, let them. If they want to live out in the suburbs and own a car, that's fine too. But let's just make sure that we give people those choices.
Yeah, and right now, the, hey, I want to live in sort of the very dense area and walk everywhere I go and walk to work. Like, those options are available in downtown Toronto and to a point a little bit in downtown London as well. And there's some more cranes in the sky right now. But I think there are more people than some would like to acknowledge who want that.
Yeah.
And private developers are willing to bet big that, yes, there are a lot of people who want this. They're betting millions of dollars on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, they are often getting prevented by either provincial rules, municipal rules. And so, and we look at other ways to get more family-friendly housing in these buildings. So one of the more wonky recommendations is around how we build apartment buildings. That in North America, we generally have rules that you need to have two sets of staircases in any apartment building, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but one of the challenges you have is if you have both of those staircases and an elevator, plus all the rules requiring every bedroom to have a window, it becomes into this big Tetris problem where it's really hard to get family-sized units in. It's why all of these, or not all of these, but a lot of these apartments and condos are basically, they're building a bunch of shoeboxes because that's easier to fit in from a Tetris point of view. So we say, well, other countries around the world don't do that. We look to Sweden, for instance. Sweden has rules that basically say if you put in a variety of fire and smoke measures in place to ensure resident safety, you can have a single staircase on buildings up to about 16 stories. And what that does is it creates extra room to be able to create family-sized units. Because we think that's really important, that it's not just about building big towers and that kind of thing with these little, you know, cramped areas, which might be fine if you're, you know, 22 or 32 without kids. But we know a lot of families want to live downtown, but they just can't find the type of units that meet their needs. And a lot of that is a regulatory issue.
Yeah, there's basically no market for, or very, very, very limited market for a three-bedroom unit in downtown London. It basically doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. Yeah. And that's not just a London thing. That's a variety of other areas. And again, a lot of that is regulatory in nature. You go to Sweden, you'll go to Spain, all of these other countries we looked at, they can make it work. They can get these really nice units. And that's just building code issues. So that's not a municipal issue. That's a provincial one. But we're saying, hey, let's look at the building code. There are ways to ensure resident safety and comfort, but still allowing for more flexible rules so you can get in those larger multi-bedroom units.
So that's at least some of the what we build portion of this. The how we build, and this kind of, like you said, they're interlocking issues, but how we build also considers environmental impact of the way that the home is built. Then there's the taxation part of this. You mentioned that, I think what your quote was something along the lines of, we shouldn't tax building a house like we tax cigarettes and alcohol.
Yeah, and we absolutely do. It cascades. It's about 31% of the cost of construction is a variety of taxes and charges, you know, whether that be, you know, federal GST down to development charges and that kind of thing. There are solutions to this. And again, it's unfortunately really wonky stuff. One of our recommendations actually comes from the Provincial Affordability Task Force on how we build water and wastewater infrastructure. What we do here in Ontario is we basically put that into development charges. So you pay for all of that up front as a homeowner. It goes into your mortgage, makes it harder to qualify for a mortgage. But if you look at a city like Edmonton, and Don Iveson was very helpful in this, it's all run as a municipal utility. And basically, you just pay for that infrastructure monthly on your bill. It doesn't show up in development charges. It lowers the overall price of home. Now, you're still paying for that infrastructure, but since you're doing it over time, you don't get this big upfront sticker shock. So again, it's a lot of these really wonky things that have made owning a home a lot more expensive over the last 20 years. Look here in London, back when I bought my first home 20 years ago, development charges on a single detached home are about $5,000. They're now up to $47,000. A lot of that is just wastewater and wastewater infrastructure, you know, has gotten really expensive. And we need to build those things and we need to invest in that infrastructure. But there's just smarter ways of doing it that don't jack up the price of a house.
And, you know, you already mentioned some of these things, but the part of this that I really liked was, and I've got it in front of me now, every level of government, you're like, I need you to do this. I need you to do this. And everyone gets a piece of the action here, the province, the feds, municipalities. So what were the key takeaways for the feds then as far as, hey, we need you to do blank?
Well, there was a number of things. We had 50 recommendations for the feds, 50 for the province, 40 for municipalities. So for the federal government, the biggest thing is just planning, right? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why we've gotten ourselves into this mess is this mismatch between population growth and the right. housing supply. So we're saying, like, look, you've got to plan this out better because...
And that rolls downhill. That hits the province and municipalities too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And one of my favorite examples is if you look in the London plan and it says, okay, this is, you know, how many people London are going to have. Our population today is larger than what the London plan says we'll have in 2035.
Right.
Part of that is municipal. You know, they got some bad private sector forecasts, but a lot of that comes from the federal government, you know, not signaling their intentions on immigration and international students and so on. So even if you had the best housing system in the world, if all of a sudden you are bringing in a large number of international students, you're going to cause a housing crisis. There, you know, you just can't build a home overnight. So that was the biggest thing we said to the federal government. But there's a lot of other things as well. Back in the 1960s, we had all kinds of tax incentives in place to build better apartment buildings. We got rid of those over time in part because they were working too well. We were actually building too many apartment buildings. We're saying, let's look at bringing those back. It's a relatively inexpensive thing to do, but could get more shovels in the ground and help build, you know, not just more housing, but more, you know, more affordable housing for families. So a lot of tax reforms, planning reforms, that kind of thing, because, you know, the federal government only has so many policy levers. Most of them are provincial and municipal in nature.
Back to the London plan example you used, you and I have been several conversations about that online. And here's the thing, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Yeah, the plan was get a good population forecast. You didn't. And yeah, you got some bad luck out at Fanshawe. I don't dispute that. But now that the bad population forecast is here, that means that everything needs to be adjusted, because the population forecast is kind of like the base element of, hey, how much housing do you need?
Yeah, absolutely. Because cities need to have basically 20 years worth of development land to make sure that they're able to build enough housing. Mm-hmm. Well, how, you know, what do you base that 20 years on? It's like, okay, what's your population forecast over those 20 years? So if you're having, you know, if your cities are growing three or four times faster than you forecast, which is the case here in London, then you're not allowing for enough density. You're not necessarily having the urban growth boundaries in the right area, particularly then as well when you've got areas within the urban growth boundary that you probably don't want to build on anyway because they're wetlands, they're prone to flooding, that kind of thing. So absolutely, that population forecasts underlie all municipal plans. And if you get those wrong, nothing else is going to work.
What about the province? Because one of the ideas might be, hey, let's not do this particular Greenbelt deal and build a bunch of McMansions. I don't know if that's in there, but what should the province be doing?
Well, a lot of it comes down to planning and less sort of ad hoc planning where, you know, the province just says, okay, we're going to, you know, block out, we're going to expand on the Greenbelt, or, you know, we're just going to arbitrarily start changing urban growth boundaries. You know, you got to have some planning in place. A lot of our recommendations, kind of ironically enough, are from the Housing Affordability Task Force report. I think we cited about 30 times in the provincial section. Mm-hmm. Because we see it as a very good place to start. And we've seen, you know, Ontario's taken some, BC's done quite a lot of it. On top of that, then you get into all of these changes in building code where, you know, I mentioned the single staircase. There's some other changes to promote energy efficiency and so on. And then finally, I think one of the big changes is to allow changes to incentivize and allow for more factory-built homes. We're not going to be able to double or triple the rate of home building by doing more of the same. And we have a lot of, you know, here in southwestern Ontario, we have a lot of great companies who are in this space, you know, trying to have more factory-built homes, but they're running into a lot of bottlenecks. One of them is just planning. You know, if you are building factory-built homes, it's a little bit different than building cars. If you've got, you know, your Stellantis plant out in Windsor, you can build 2 or 3 months worth of cars and just put them on a parking lot somewhere. You can't do that with factory-built homes. It's the ultimate just-in-time model. So if there are municipal or provincial delays, what happens is those homes get stuck in the factory and they have to shut down the factory for weeks at a time. Mm-hmm. So it's planning there. It's have some tax incentives to help some of those companies go, and some what we call like minimum order things. A lot of these companies have trouble surviving recessions because home building is such a it goes along with the economic cycle. So what we suggest in the report is if we find ourselves in a recession and home building is low, that's the time where government should be stepping in and buying purchasing affordable homes. Right, and kind of timing along the business cycle so that way we can have more consistent home building and we're not in these boom bust cycles, which unfortunately tend to take out these, you know, factory built homes, these panelization, you know, factories and so on. Smoothing out that demand is really important.
Yeah, just so, because, you know, and you've shared some of these graphs online and elsewhere and in various reports. Sometimes you see, okay, we built, you know, 100,000 homes in this year, and then we built, you know, 10,000 homes the next year. I'm just pulling numbers out of my head. I don't know. But you see what I mean. If it's going up and down like a roller coaster, that's not going to be good for planning or consistency or any of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the sort of historic home building method is what you end up seeing is a lot of skilled trades workers who just, you know, don't work for a year or two at a time, but they all sort of come back. But if you have a factory-built approach, the challenge there is that once you stop building, it's hard to pay those bills. So the companies just go under. Then when home building comes back, there's nothing to return to. So absolutely, smoothing out those boom-bust cycles is incredibly important. And since governments want to build affordable housing anyway, need to build affordable housing, what we're suggesting is, you know, time it a little bit better on the business cycle. Mm-hmm. When home building is booming, back off a little bit and say, okay, you know what, the market's taking care of this. And when the market starts to struggle, say, okay, this is the time we're going to go in. And it's actually better for the taxpayer as well, because you're buying those homes when they're at their most cheapest.
Right.
So you can actually get more affordable housing. You get more bang for your buck.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, when we're talking about something a little more dense, as far as, you know, mid-rise level apartments, affordable housing projects like that, if these tradespeople that you're talking about are not working on all these other projects, maybe you can get them in there for perhaps not as much as you would have had to pay otherwise when you're competing against the private sector to do the very same stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. Yeah. So it's not just the factories as well, but it's all the electricians, the plumbers, the roofers, the sheet metal workers, and so on. So absolutely. So timing out that demand is incredibly important.
What about municipalities? We talked about it a little bit already, but what more do we need to see from them? And if I know London political leaders listen to this podcast, what's your message to them about this?
Yeah, so there's a number of things. So obviously, as we mentioned earlier, looking at the approvals process and just, you know, being able to streamline that better. But we have a number of other recommendations. I mentioned the parking minimum one is incredibly important. One really bold one, and I don't know if there's going to be much uptake on this, but, you know, we're hoping. We decided we wanted to have some bold recommendations.
Good.
There are so many discussions out there about, you know, legalizing triplexes or legalizing fourplexes or things like that. Like, how many units should we get in a lot? What we suggest is get rid of those rules entirely.
Right.
On how many, and people go, what does that mean? That you're going to be able to build 1,000 units on any one lot? Well, no, not necessarily.
Because this stretches the bounds of physical confines.
Well, exactly. Because there's so many other rules like height restrictions, like lot setbacks, coverage ratios, where the buildings can only cover like 50% or so of the lot. We're saying if you have all of those rules already, you don't need to then superimpose a unit maximum on it. Because it doesn't make sense to us why you could build a 14-room McMansion on a large piece of land, but you couldn't, say, split it up and say, okay, we're going to have 7 units of 2 bedrooms each. You know, either way, you've got 14 bedrooms. We're saying that these unit restrictions are completely arbitrary. They just cause red tape, and they don't allow for more efficient uses of larger pieces of land. So we're saying you don't need them, and actually most of the world doesn't have them. They're largely a North America thing. So we're saying, you know, let all of these other things dictate how many units go on a lot. Don't just set some arbitrary number and go, okay, 3 or 4 or whatever is the right maximum. Let it be determined by the site rather than by, you know, just some arbitrary government rule. That's really bold. Don't know if governments are going to go there, but we're hoping to push them a little bit.
I could not, I would not look forward to the neighborhood meetings if we were going to be doing that, because you would have those standard meetings where people come to City Hall and they get very, very mad about the number of units that are going to be on their street. And, but I don't care, to be clear, but that's how it would go.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. Yeah. And there are these challenges on infill, but we should also recognize that these rules will also apply to greenfield sites as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you got some developer who says, well, yeah, I could kind of sever these, make 3 or 4 lots, or why don't I just build one larger building there? Allow them to do that, you know, but it should be those market conditions that dictate that, because otherwise what you're basically doing is saying sort of by law, no, we're going to limit the amount of housing, which doesn't make sense during a housing crisis. You would think we'd be going the other way of having, you know, having minimum number of units, but, you know, that's probably a bridge too far. But it just doesn't make sense to me that in a housing crisis, we're placing these artificial limits on the number of units that could be put in place.
So we are in a crisis, as you said. And I know, how bad is the crisis right now? For people who may not realize, okay, how big a problem this is, when someone says, okay, how much of a crisis is this right now, what do you tell them?
Well, I say look at what's happened to rents. Rents are the obvious thing to look at, because home prices, you could say, well, you know, the interest rates and this and that. But look at rents. That rents are up across the country about 20 to 25% over the last 2 years. Yeah, here in London, I think they went up about 90% on new leases over about a 5-year period or so. And, you know, I can tell you, like incomes and nothing else is going up 90%.
No.
So it's absolutely a crisis level. And I think people are sort of recognizing that. And, you know, you can look at any kind of data. For instance, in Toronto, until about 2015, the average condo would cost the average person about 30% of their income, you know, to pay for not just the condo, like the mortgage fees and all the other fees and so on. Right now, according to the CMHC, it's closer to about 70% because prices are high, interest rates are high, or so on. So, you know, 30% of their income, most, you know, people would feel that, but they could pull it off. 70%, that just doesn't leave money for anything else. So we basically blocked out first-time home buyers from the market. Last year, home sales were down 11% over the year before. This year's not looking to be another good year. And just think about that. At a time where we have record population growth, we're also having record low home sales. So that kind of shows the disconnect. We got more people needing homes, but fewer of them being sold just because of the supply-demand mismatch and what's happening to interest rates.
Yeah, and people are holding on to their houses for, I think, longer than a lot of politicians, a lot of government workers would have projected.
Yeah,
for a variety of reasons.
For a variety of reasons, yeah. So every city forecasts something called generational turnover. So I'll use my parents as an example. You know, they have a four-bedroom home out in Oak Ridge that they don't use all that much of. And there had always been this assumption among planners that, oh, that, you know, folks like my parents in their mid-70s, they would hit a certain point and then they downsize. The thing they didn't really think about is, what are they going to downsize into?
Yeah.
You look around, you know, and, you know, use my parents as an example. If they want to stay in Oak Ridge and they want a smaller, smaller house, there's really not a lot they can move into. It's kind of a lateral move. And then once you pay, realtor fees, land transfer taxes, and so on, you're probably losing 10% of that sale. So you're not even saving that much money in the long run by downsizing when there are all these costs and fees and taxes on top of it. So what we're seeing is a lot of seniors basically age in place. Go, yeah, you know what? This is too much home for me, but there's nowhere I can really go. And what that causes is the next generation of young families can't buy those homes because they're not going on the market.
Yeah, yeah. My mom lives out in St. Mary's, and she just loves putting around her garden, all that stuff, and she doesn't want to go to a place where she doesn't have the ability to do that, and so she stays, you know? And therefore, the assumption that, okay, you know, she's going to sell this home and some young family is going to move into the four-bedroom house she has in St. Mary's. It's not going to happen. At least not for now. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. And it's something that the cities, I think, have gotten wrong over the last 10 years. And again, they do all this modeling, and this modeling is important. I don't want to suggest for a moment that they shouldn't be doing these kinds of forecasts. But I think they just misunderstood that, you know, just because you want to do something doesn't mean you're going to be able to. And just because these seniors may want to downsize doesn't mean they're going to be able to if that inventory isn't there. And yeah, so many seniors that I talked to said, yeah, I'd love to downsize, but I don't, you know, I still want to have a patio where I can, I can have barbecues in the summer. I still want to have an extra bedroom just in case the grandkids come to visit, that kind of thing. So having a small shoebox condo doesn't really fit their needs, but we're not really building the things that do fit their needs. And again, even if we were, all of those fees and taxes and charges, just, you know, the economics of it doesn't really work.
Doesn't match up. I want to talk about why we build before we wrap up here. And this is right from the report. It says, homes are for people. Everyone in Canada has the right to live somewhere in security, peace, and dignity. This requires us to not only build enough homes for all, but for every income level that are also low carbon and resilient to the effects of climate change. So there's a lot there to think about. But the key thing is, we have a homelessness crisis in the city. That's the housing crisis is part of the homeless crisis. The two things are woven together, obviously. We have not built enough homes, so it's going to take us a little while to catch up. We've got to just start catching up sooner rather than later, immediately, essentially, because crisis, it says what it means, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in the report, we advocate for a homelessness benefit that is not just designed for people who are experiencing homelessness, but the best bang for the buck that you get is preventing it in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you can design these programs for the people who are kind of on edge, going to have trouble making rent next month. You can create these supplements to prevent them from falling into homelessness. And it's far, far cheaper in the long run to keep people where they are rather than falling into homelessness. And one of the other things we talk in the why section is, you know, I've talked a lot about, you know, deregulation and all these regulatory, these very sort of market-based things. We have to recognize that there is a segment of the population, you know, 20, 30, 40%, that the market is never, even if you do these reforms, the market's never going to be able to adequately meet their needs. So there needs to be a rule for social housing. There needs to be a rule for what we call acquisition funds. So if you have housing that's already relatively affordable for market reasons or another, there are tax incentives and other things that you can create to allow for not-for-profit groups to be able to purchase these homes and run them, you know, at low cost to keep those units affordable. Because one of the challenges we're having as prices rise, every unit of affordable housing we are building, we're losing 10 to 11 units on the other side, and those units aren't going anywhere. They're just the prices are getting jacked up, and they're no longer affordable. So, you know, we've got to balance that out a bit, because if we're losing 10 units for every unit that we create, you know, we're never going to make the problem better. We're just going to be digging ourselves a larger and larger hole. So we felt that was particularly important to recognize, yes, we need market reforms, but there's a big role for the not-for-profit sector and for government in these solutions.
Yeah, I'm looking at the report right now. It's in front of me, and I've got the homelessness prevention and housing benefit stuff in front of me. It all makes a ton of sense. And there is definitely a government role here. And the federal government stopped building housing in the Cretchen-Martin era. And we're still, well, not still. We have been feeling the effects of that for a while, and we're really feeling the effects of it now, that there used to be spots that were run by the federal government that people could go if they were having a tough time or if they were low income or whatever it happens to be. And those spots are few and far between. And here in London, they are very, very poorly taken care of in a lot of cases. So there's a lot of problems there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But there are solutions. Yeah. And again, some of these get really wonky, but I think we have to be creative when we're in a crisis like this. So one example, and we can look here in London, there are a lot of underused strip malls that are, you know, oftentimes have been owned by families for generations, but they're not, you know, they're not getting used that much. You know, the stores, you know,
there's five units and two of them are rented.
Exactly. Yeah. And the two that are sort of competing cell phone kiosks,
right,
or what have you.
Yeah.
So what we suggest in that is that if you have one of those, that a tax break could be given to the owner, you know, a reduced capital cost or a capital gains allowance, if the owner sells that to a not-for-profit group to convert into housing. Because, you know, at a time where we don't have enough places to build, we've also got all of these, you know, whether it be office towers or other things, where we've got this land, we've got these buildings, they're highly underused. Can we look to convert them? And that could be just a straight conversion, or sometimes that is going to be a teardown, where it's like, okay, you know, this building has outlived its useful life. Let's convert it into something else. And if we can help a not-for-profit group convert that into much-needed housing, so much the better.
Yeah, I can think of a few places that maybe would be good for something like that. Any other takeaways from the report or things that you want people to look for on this, Mike, before we wrap up here?
Well, I know there's a lot here.
Because
we're trying to accomplish four really difficult things at the same time. Building enough homes, making them affordable, making sure we don't blow past our climate targets, but also making them resilient to the effects of climate change. But I think we've got a fantastic report here. You know, we had representation across the ideological spectrum. So our job now is to work with governments to try and help implement these. So, you know, I'm just back from Nova Scotia. I had a meeting with the government out in Halifax. You know, we've talked to the federal government. We've talked to a variety of provinces. So now what we're looking for is, you know, the federal government has a budget on April 16th. We're hoping mm-hmm. some of these are in there. And we're told that the Ford government says that they're coming out with a housing bill every year. Last one was about 12 months ago, so they're kind of overdue.
Yeah, you're due.
We're due. So we're hoping that some of these ideas really resonate with government. And, you know, I'd love to hear from you if there are ideas in there that you say, oh, wow, okay, I hadn't really thought about that before. That's interesting. let me know. I'd love to hear it, because one of the challenges we have is prioritization. When you've got 140 different recommendations, it's always hard to know what to put in the window. So, you know, we'd love hearing from folks going, oh, okay, that's an interesting idea. Could we learn more about it?
So I'm going to put a link to the report on the description of this podcast, and it's at housingandclimate.ca if you want to go look it up. But there'll be a link in the description of this podcast. If you're listening to it right now, you'll just be able to click right on there. It'll get right to it. Because, there's a lot in here, like Mike says, and, there are wonky things in here, as you said, but it's all important. It's all good. And it's definitely things that people at all levels of government need to be looking at closely, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I love if, any listener could go check it out, ask questions. I'm not hard to find. No. And some of the other authors aren't hard to find as well. Yeah, I'd just love to hear it, because we are trying to build a movement of people who care about the housing crisis, but also care about the climate crisis and want to make sure that we don't make one problem worse while we're trying to solve the other.
Yeah, I think that is a good way to look at it. Mike, thank you so much for coming and doing this, and thank you so much for being here in person today.
Yeah, no, it's so much fun to be able to do this in person and to be in a room with you.
And wearing the London Tigers baseball hoodie as well. That's great stuff.
Well, I got to play to the hometown crowd while I'm here in London.
That's Mike Moffitt joining us here on the Craig Needles podcast. Of course, you can find Mike all over the place. He's at Mike P. Moffitt on Twitter, Place Center, and various other places that you may find Mike. The Craig Needles podcast can be found at classicrock981.com, londonnewstoday.ca, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Craig Needles podcast is powered by Downtown London and the Covent Garden Market.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.